We left off talking about the freedom from the four attachments. And I will go over those briefly, just to frighten you again. A person who is still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. A person who is still attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. A person who is still attached to getting what they want is no Bodhisattva. A person who still grasps to things has no worldview. And we were talking about the first one, attachment to life. And attachment to life basically is talking about attachment to the pleasures of life, of this life, the worldly life. And those pleasures are small. They're not going to get you anywhere. They don't last longer than, you know, you're engaging in them. They are not causes for any kind of advancement at all. And while we are attached to them, we can't practice. You know, we're more concerned about ourselves. We're more concerned about getting those small pleasures than we are with anything else. And we don't practice Dharma. So that's one meaning of this first line. A person who was still attached to this life is no Dharma practitioner. Practicing Dharma basically means leading an ethical way of life. You know, and the things that we choose to do with our life must be driven by our understanding of emptiness, by our understanding of karma, and not by anything else. You know, not by what we learned in church. Not by what our culture tells us, or anything else. These influences, whatever they are, they always change, and they're not reliable for us. We can't count on them. If we think something's working all right, and it's not Dharma, eventually it will not be working all right. So, Buddhist morality is where we need to go on these. Now, it's probably the case that Buddhist morality overlaps a lot of, you know, our upbringing. You know, what our culture says is right, what our religious upbringing says is right or wrong. But the part that doesn't overlap is the very, very important part. You know, that part will allow us to avoid getting old and dying. We can choose to change our life in a way, to change our karma, to change our projections in such a way that we can assume the body of an angel, and that's a light body. And that body will not die. So we have to get out of this realm, you know. We have to stop doing these negative deeds and purify the ones that are there sometime during this life in order to not die. We have to do that. And morality is the way to do it. So our morality, the way that we lead our life, must be driven by the goal of not dying. And that goal alone is what's going to guide us. So, it means go after the things that get us out of this realm and go after the things that will prevent our death, that will enable us to not die. You know, we can do it. The text says we can do it. And we have to learn a system and keep it. You know, regardless of what other people say, regardless of what our society says, regardless of what our friends might say, anything else. Once we find that path, once we understand it, then that's what we put our anchor in. Nothing else will work for us, and we just have to stand fast. So that's kind of one part of attachment to life, freedom from attachment to life. There's another part, and that has to do with really how we practice. And those are the three things of learning, contemplation, and meditation, which we had in Course 1, 400 years ago or whenever that was. We have to think for ourselves. We can't let anybody else do the path for us. So our spiritual practice is a personal journey, you know, and it's based on our own ideas about what we should do, our own decisions about what we should do. And those decisions are ones that we make independent of any influence outside of ourselves other than the Dharma. We have checked it out. We've thought about it. We've debated. We've meditated. We've contemplated. And we come down to a place that, yes, this is how I'm going to lead my life. So any teaching that we get, we have to test, you know, will it work for me? You have to ask that question for any teaching that you get, for me or Geshe Michael or anywhere else, you know, any self-help program you might go to. You have to ask that. Ask it of advertisements that you see. Will that get me to my goal? So we have to take time to study. We have to take time to contemplate, you know, just sitting down and thinking about something. And we have to take time to meditate on these things. You know, if we have too many possessions, it drags our mind toward them and not toward Dharma practice. So we kind of have to clear away things that we don't need. The point here is that the priorities of our culture are wrong. We're supposed to have lots of things. We're not successful if we don't have lots of things. If we don't have lots of things, we are poor. And that's not a good thing to be. But those ideas are wrong. The possessions that we have draw us away to Dharma practice. And then we can talk about anything else as well, anything that we think we want. A good job, being recognized as a good worker or a good manager, or a good whatever you want to be, having a nice family, any of those things are not the things that are going to help us along the path. And we have to be careful about that. This does not mean that we live in a hut with nothing there. It does not mean we leave our families. It does not mean we quit our job. It means that we are not looking to those things to provide us for the guidance that we need to lead our life properly so that we don't die. So, you know, with regard to giving away possessions, you know, it might be kind of easy once we decide to do it to give away a few things, you know, to sort of empty out our closets a little bit and, you know, have more space in our rooms. There's no clutter. It's just sort of a nice, comfortable, clean place to be in. But what we really have to do is give up our attachment to all of these things. We have to give up our attachment to our civilization's way of thinking about things. And this is very difficult. So according to Buddhism, you know, if you don't break the attachment to this life, you will die, you know. So we have to prioritize the things that we do. We do good things. Yep, we want to do that. But then within those, we have to prioritize which are the best good things I could be doing right now. Which are the most powerful ones, and we concentrate on those. So we do our Dharma practice, and as we're doing our Dharma practice and taking a look at which are the things that we should be doing, which of the good things that we do are the ones that we should really concentrate on, then our Dharma practice is much, much more powerful. So an example is that we should practice our bodhisattva morality ahead of pranamoksha morality. And we should concentrate on tantric practices if you've taken an initiation. So attachment to this life basically means that we're failing to put our efforts into the highest practice that we can do. Putting like our bodhisattva practice above our pranamoksha practice doesn't mean that they ignore the pranamoksha vows. We cannot do that. But in terms of what we do, our guidelines are taken from the bodhisattva vows. And then if we have tantric initiation, it doesn't mean we forget about pranamoksha vows and bodhisattva vows. We have to keep all of them. But our efforts now go into keeping the tantric vows. Because those are the ones that are going to get us ahead more quickly than the others. So, every time we move up a level in our practice, then we don't stay at the lower levels. And we don't avoid the practices that we've decided are the best ones that we can do. We have to do those. They're difficult, but doing them and adhering to that means that we have to have faith and courage. We have to have more faith and more courage to make it work. So go after the best things you can do. Go after the highest virtues. In the practice of giving, give to those who most need it, the most powerful objects, and so on. In the practice of not getting angry, be around people who make you angry the most, so that you can really practice not getting angry at them. It's absolutely no value being around people that never make you angry. And that's all. It doesn't get you anywhere with regard to the practice of patience. So another thing you have to think about is that you don't move up a level until you are ready to do that. If you do, you're going to fail because you won't be able to understand really the reasons for doing what you're doing. You won't think it's worthwhile, and then you lose faith in the practice, and then your entire practice crumbles as the result of that. So be careful. You know what you can do. You know what works for you. And when you're ready to try something higher, then you go for that. And then it will work for you. So the second of the four attachment says a person who is still attached to the three worlds has no renunciation. Now, in the reading, the three worlds here, in fact, refer not to the three realms, but to the three kinds of suffering, which is obvious pain, change, the pain or suffering of change, and all-pervasive suffering or all-pervasive pain. So Lama Drakpa Gyaltsen talks about these three pains, and he spends a lot of time on the first one, which is the obvious pain. Where does that come from? And we have to think about that. He's concentrating on obvious pain because this relates directly to the three lower realms. Craving spirits are there, as we learned a couple of weeks ago, because they were stingy in this life, because they were never satisfied with what they had. They were cheap with others. They didn't help other people at all. And they were attached to money or something like that, power, maybe food. They were attached to their possessions, and they held on to them for dear life. And then they died. And in the death process, the unripened karma, which is pervaded now by greed, by stinginess, by not being satisfied, projects them into having a projection of never being satisfied at all, that they can never get what they want. In this life, they may have gotten what they want. It wasn't worth anything to them. But in the next life, they can't get anything what they want. Their perception changes. Now, if you look at greedy people in this life, you know, humans, they're not very happy, typically. Getting what they want is usually very, very expensive. But they're still after it all the time, going, going, going. But in their new projection, they can't get anything at all, and they're always on the run from one place to another. They see something that looks nice, and they go there, and it's not nice. It can't satisfy them. They can't take it because of their bodies. And this is a projection. What they did in this life, when they died, projected them into kind of an essence of the way that they led this life. And that's a new life where they can't get anything at all. And we have to think about that. We have to be very, very careful about what we do. Not go after things. Renunciation means that you realize that the things of this life do not work for you. That's a deep understanding. And it probably happens fairly quickly, maybe even all of a sudden. Like, I get it, you know. Something really, really bad happens to you. And all of a sudden you understand, right, nothing in this world is anything I can rely on. Nothing at all. So renunciation, of course, is part of attachment to this life. If you don't have it, then you are attached to this life. One of the problems of renunciation, though, is if you get it and don't have a path to work on, you don't see a way out. And I think a lot of suicides are the result of this. So we're talking about the suffering of pain, the first kind of suffering that's in the text. And we covered the suffering that craving spirits get. And then in the reading, there's a sutra. It's called the Sutra Requested by Upali, where Lord Buddha describes the hell realms. And he says, you know, the people there, the places, the hell realms, don't exist at all. You know, there aren't any torture chambers there. There aren't any axes or knives or anything else. There was no company that built the hell realms. It's a projection. It's an entire world that is very, very real, just like this one, and it comes from the projections of the people who are there, who are experiencing the hell realms. Now, hell can be a potential problem for us because it is a projection. On the one hand, if we don't really understand karma and emptiness, but kind of get this projection part, then it's, oh, well, it's just a projection. It's not really there. And that's a wrong view. It is really there. Just as the world around you right now and the people in your life and your body and everything else is really there for you, it's there only because it's a projection. Because there isn't anything that exists independent of your projection of it. This is the understanding of emptiness. The projection is due to karma, the way we treated others in the past. You know, there isn't any judge that sends you to hell or to the craving spirit realm or to the animal realm or to the human realm, for that matter, or to nirvana. It doesn't work that way. There's no committee. There's no outside agent that sends you anywhere at all when you die. What sends you there is the ripening of the karma, basically the essence of the way that you led your life, that ripens in a way that provides you with a new kind of projection, a new set of projections. So the hells are very real, you know. The hell realms are not a metaphor. We can't think of them like that. Do they exist? Yes. Why? Because they're projections. So, you know, in the same way that we can view a cylinder, we can view it as a pen, or it can be viewed as a chew toy to a dog. You know, the world we live in depends on our point of view. Our point of view allows us to see a cylinder as a pen, and it allows a dog to see the cylinder as a chew toy. And it allows beings in the hell realm to experience horrible suffering continually for billions of years. So the world around us is the raw material for either heaven or hell, you know, or a little bit of both, you know. And the little bit of both is probably what we could call our human existence. If you straightened out your karma, then you'd be seeing it as something wonderful, as a Buddha paradise, the place where you're totally happy, the place where everything is perfect. We could do that. People have done it, and they are living there now, an untold number of them, countless. It's been done, and Lord Buddha has shown us the path to do that. Or the raw material around us could be projecting the human realm, or it could be projecting a pleasure being realm, or it could be projecting an animal realm, and so on. The stuff around us is neutral. It's kind of like a blank screen, and we project onto that our reality, and that reality is, well, real. You know, even in this life, our mind can shift from great happiness to great suffering, just like that. You know, we all know that the pleasures we may have from a good meal or being with friends or whatever last for maybe a few minutes and then they're gone. Suffering itself doesn't last, you know. Eventually it disappears too. But the goal, the sort of unstated universal goal for all beings is to be happy, is to not suffer. That's what we want. It just turns out that the things that we do to be happy are the things that make us unhappy. And until we get our view straightened out and we understand what's going on and we do the things then to create a good world for us, until we get that straight, then we are going to experience suffering. We will experience happiness, too, from time to time, and suffering from time to time. But we don't want the suffering part. We want the good part. We want the happiness part. So I guess the point, you know, which I've been making for I don't know how many years now, is, you know, the change in our perceptions is just a change in perception. The change in perception is due to our karma. And if we want good perceptions, then we generate the karma to get them. And if we want bad perceptions, then we generate the karma to get those too. We typically don't want bad perceptions, but nonetheless, we're generating the karma to have them. And now we've got a way to stop generating that bad karma, to purify ourselves of negative karma, so that those seeds don't ripen, or they ripen quickly in a very kind of ineffective way. And that's what we do. We're on the path. We're practicing. and we're learning how to generate our Buddha paradise. Now, somewhere along the way of in your practice, you will get an understanding of emptiness. It's called Jorlam Supa, where you cannot be born in the hell realm. That will probably happen on the path of preparation. That's the Jorlam part. You know, you'll reach a point where you've purified enough bad karma and you're not generating serious bad karma anymore, that you will never again be born in a hell realm, at least for a long time. We do slip, and we've been doing this from, you know, since the beginning of this time. But for a while, we'll have enough good karma and purified bad karma so that we don't take rebirth in a hell realm. You know, and again, a dog is not something furry that licks your face. A dog is a collection of experiences or perceptions. You know, a dog is a being who sees its skin as furry to itself. So the second attachment to this life is the attachment to your idea that the world cannot change. Renunciation lets you know that it can change. First of all, you understand that it doesn't work. And along with that comes some understanding. I wonder why it's been this way. There must be a reason for it. So that's what we do, you know. The way to stay out of the hell realms is to keep our vows. Simple as that. Okay, next kind of suffering is the suffering of change. Even if we're born as a human, which we have been, we live in a world where every good thing that we experience in our life changes. It stops being pleasant. Relationships must end in a loss at some point. You know, either through death or dislike or boredom, you know, something like that. Our marriage vows make it explicit, till death us do part. You know, when death comes, we're gone. The relationship is over. Our jobs, you know, are always stained by dissatisfaction. We're never really quite happy with what we do. Even as managers, even as owners of companies, there always seems to be something that we're not really satisfied with. And as just low-level employees, you know, the job sucks. And we are not hesitant to tell everybody else about that. And that's what going to a bar after work on Friday is all about, is to commiserate with everybody else about how lousy our work has been this week. So in this realm, even if you get everything that we want, we can't avoid the mind shifting and becoming dissatisfied several months later, or sometimes even a few minutes later. It's just not enough. So our mind is cursed by our shifting karma. Our projections are cursed by our shifting karma. Now, that's the way karma works, you know. And it worked one way to get us a human rebirth. The sum of our past lives got us to a human rebirth after our last life. But we're in the desire realm. The desire realm is the place where we are attracted to objects of the senses, and it's the place where that attraction causes us to create negative karma. And that attraction and the negative karma is what keeps us in cyclic existence in the desire realm. So we have to use our understanding of emptiness, you know, in order to begin to change this. We have to learn what karma is about. We have to take vows and keep them so that we can manipulate our karma and our projections into a place that we really want to be in and are happy, truly happy in, you know, where there isn't any suffering for us. And we can do that. We're learning how to do that. I think most of you have already done it in many ways. You know, we're still in a desire realm, so, you know, the happiness doesn't last as long, but the happiness you're experiencing is probably getting greater. I would expect the unhappiness is also greater, too, when it occurs, and that's due to purification. And we just have to ride that out, and it takes courage to ride that out, knowing that the result is going to be good at the end. We wouldn't be doing this if we weren't sure that things were going to be better for us than they are right now. And all of you are leading good lives, you know. You got food, you got shelter, you got friends, and that's really pretty good, you know. And you know it can be better. You know it can be permanent for you. And that's why you're doing the practice. So what we do really in this is spend a lot of time with the perfection of wisdom, understanding emptiness, a deep understanding of emptiness. And by doing that, then we create everlasting happiness. There is in your reading a line that says, "The mystic power of this good deed." It's on page 38. And this refers basically, for basic good deeds, you know, of a Lodron practitioner. Mainly, this is not worrying about yourself, and it is taking care of other people, which is the Bodhisattva vows that we took. Remember, Lodron is developing a good heart, developing bodhicitta. So any Lodron teaching is going to be about forgetting about taking care of yourself and taking care of others instead. So the mystic power in here, in that line, is the desire that others' pain come to you so they don't have to experience it. So you take it upon yourself. That frees them of that pain. And this is especially important at the moment of your death. You know, doing this doesn't get them enlightened because their bad karma is due to their mind, you know, and no one really can take away somebody else's bad karma except the person themselves. But the mystical power of the good deed, you know, is that that prayer, that desire to take on other people's pain gets you enlightened faster. And the more sincere you are in that, the more you really want to take on other people's pain, take on their suffering, the more powerful your practice becomes, the greater your compassion becomes. And then you can teach others how to do the same thing. And you do that for their benefit. So Lama Drapa Gyaltsen says, "No, do this. Do it every day in the form of a prayer. Imagine you're dying, you know, and you're taking on other people's pain. When you're doing Tonglen practice, if you do it, have this new motivation. You're taking their suffering away from them. You want them to be happy because it is going to be a good thing for you. And when their suffering comes into you, into your heart, and that nuclear explosion annihilates it. It annihilates your bad karma as well. So that practice is good for you. It gets you to enlightenment much more quickly. So the third and fourth lines of the four attachments, there is more commentary in your reading about it, about those, and you can read those over. The basic parts of it, the really important part, are in the first two lines. So we're going to turn now to something called the 12-point Lojong. It's called the Celestial Mansions in your reading. Celestial Mansions refer to to 12 areas in the sky that the Asian astrologers called mansions. We know them as the signs of the zodiac. And what the celestial mansions, this Lojong practice is doing, is it's describing 12 spiritual qualities, 12 behaviors that people who are successfully practicing Lojong will develop. So here's number one. The Tibetan word is yiche, and we can translate that as trustworthy. People like this, you can count on them to do what they say. It's not like politicians, you know. These people don't let you down. President Harry Truman was a senator for a while, or representative, I forget which. But he had the reputation of being very honest. He once told the leader of the Senate that he would support a bill, and then he found out that he couldn't, and he went to the leader and said, "I've got to change my mind. I wanted you to know, but I can't support this bill." You know, and he had that reputation. What he said, he did. He followed through. He didn't let people down. So this idea of trustworthiness is something that a Dharma practitioner, a bodhisattva, a Lojong practitioner develops. The second one, the Tibetan, is Kadrin Dren, and it means loyal. This is where you are particularly associated with your friends, with people who have done things for you. People who have helped you, you don't let them down. You know, you help them back. You do good things for them. If they need help, you provide it for them. You remember their kindness. You know, this is the way of paying them back, is helping them. You remember their sweetness. And you pay that back to them. You're loyal to them. You support them. And this is especially true of people who have helped you in your practice. And that's really the people we're talking about. But you do it to others as well. People who have helped you become very powerful objects for you, more than just people you pass on the street. And so this is being loyal, is really being loyal to them. The third quality is called helpful. Meaning you always help people who need it. And the key here is need it. Another key is that you have what they need. So if people need things and you've got them and you can give them, you do that. You're always helping people. You're giving them things that they need, whether that's material things or Dharma teachings or advice or mentoring or whatever it turns out to be, you do that for them. The fourth one, oh, that was called Mila Rok. And the fourth one is called Punlajam. And this means friendly. And it's friendly to everybody, you know. You're easy to be around. You aren't aloof. You aren't distant when you're with a bunch of people. You're friendly to them. You're friendly with them. If these are close friends, it doesn't mean you have to be talking. You can be friendly, you know, just being quiet. That works too. But you're gentle. You're kind. You talk easily, and you talk in a friendly way. Not noisy or anything else. Number five is Shenla Kelchen, which means courteous. And here, you pay attention to what's going on with people. You're sensitive to people's reactions to what you do. And you react in an appropriate way to them. If what you're saying to them seems to make them happy, then kind of reinforce that. If it seems to make them angry, maybe you step back. Unless, of course, it's somebody very close to you and you're trying to teach them a lesson. But you do it in love on top of that. You help people carry things. You open the doors for people like that. Very important. Give up your seat on the bus. All those kinds of things. Number six is called Shengi Jen, and this means kind. Here, you become the servant of other people. You're doing what they want you to do in a kind way. You're taking care of their needs, of their desires. They want something, they can't get it from themselves, you help them do that. It may mean they're doing a difficult job and you help them do that too. You just give. You are their servant. Anybody's servant. Everybody's servant. Number seven is Dulwar Nyen, which means obedient. This means that you do what your lama asks. You listen very carefully, clarifying what your lama wants if need be, and then you do what they want you to do. And remember, your lama can be anybody else. It doesn't have to be the person you've asked to be your teacher. But you do it, you do what they want obediently. Number eight is Zum Karchen, means cheerful. So you're happy, you know. You don't get in foul moods or even kind of cut-off moods. You're never grumpy. You're cheerful. You're happy. What you do happily. People know that that when you're doing some tasks, you're doing it happily, and they are impressed by that. You don't complain. You don't whine. You know, you're just cheerful all the time. Number nine is Tunze Bakyu. It means thrifty. And here, you don't waste things. You don't use resources in a wasteful way. You use only what you need. So you turn the lights off in the house when you're not in a room. You do things like that. You don't buy things you're never going to use. You know, we were talking in Hamburg, you know, for most people, they throw away 20% of the food that they buy. So you become more aware of what you're going to eat and when, and don't overbuy. You know, if you buy things and don't use it, the food spoils and then you have to throw it away. It's things like that. Just buy what you need and no more than that. Don't waste the planet's resources. Number 10 is Patakten, which means brave. And this is the Bodhisattva warrior. You know, you're courageous. You know, you understand your worldview and you stick to it regardless, no matter what. You always do the right thing, regardless of the immediate consequences. When you do something good, something bad cannot happen as the result of that. If something bad does happen, it's due to something else that you've done beforehand. It's not due to what you did. So we have to keep that in mind. You know, you act on emptiness. You understand emptiness, and everything you do is an act of truth. And you never vary from that. You just don't. Number 11 is Daqing So, which means clean. This is where you create your own paradise, you know. It's a pure land. It's simple, pleasant to be in, very, very pleasant to be in. And what you do here is keep your home clean, uncluttered, the same with your office space. Try to keep your schedules uncluttered. If you're a manager, make sure that you don't make appointments that are really not necessary. Keep your schedule clean. It's also important at that point that when you're in a meeting, that you be there at the meeting consciously, present all the time, that your mind is in someplace else. And if you have too many things to think about, then you can't be present. So being clean, you know, means create your pure land now. Everything you do by being clean in this life will produce a pure land for you. And number 12 is Chusem Shul, and it means reverent. So instead of your mind, you know, sort of traveling, what does it say? Being in the moment, no, that's not the right word. Go with the flow. Going with the flow typically means going with the worldly flow. And we don't do that. Being reverent means that your mind goes with the flow of the Dharma teachings, and that's it. You understand things, and you base your behavior and your actions and everything else on your understanding of what's the best thing to do right now. And you adhere to that. Your teachings are holy. Your practice is holy. And you keep it that way, regardless. So when Geshe-la taught us these 12, along around the number 4 or 5, those of us who had been Boy Scouts were kind of leaning forward. And somebody finally said, that's the Boy Scout theme. And yeah, every Scout meeting at the beginning, we'd hold up our three fingers and kind of a mudra, you know, and recite these 12. And Geshe-la thought that would be good too. So as our practice gets more powerful, we can begin to rewrite the history of our life. So we will have a spiritual level where we understand that the early influences in our life were not those for normal people. If you sit down and talk with your Dharma friends and ask, well, when did you first know you were different? A lot of you are going to say, oh, around 10 maybe. And think back, you know. You may have encountered the Dharma, you know, the Buddha Dharma just recently. But did you have some sort of understanding that there was more to life than was evident? Did you have an understanding earlier in your life? And then you begin to kind of rewrite. Yeah, I did, you know. And then this Boy Scout code begins to make some sense. And you can begin to look at your earlier experiences according to these 12 qualities. Were they beginning to develop already? Can you find the seeds for that? And along with this, this is where we remember that Buddhas appear to us in any form, all the time. So there's never been a time when they haven't been around. We haven't recognized it, perhaps, but they've always been there, doing whatever they could to help, you know, to get us a realization, to send us to a particular experience that would help us develop renunciation or understand emptiness or, you know, whatever it turned out to be. So the people in your lives, your teachers, school teachers, for example, become your lamas. They're Buddhas, and your parents and your good friends and your enemies as well. So that's the class for today. If there are questions, now is a good time.
Yes, I have a question. Venerable Sir, you said that we learned that everyone is our Lama, and you said that we have to fulfill our Lama's wish. So does that also mean that everyone in my life who is telling me something, I have to fulfill everyone's wish at any time?
Oh, you always do that within your understanding of your morality. Emptiness and karma.
So, everyone.
Yeah, everyone, including your lamas, you know, me or Geshe-la or anybody else. Mm-hmm. You've got to evaluate it and says, is this really the truth? Mm-hmm. Will this work for me? And if the answer is no, then you don't do it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.